and become women at 7 years, and by the time they can count 10 years, most girls have become women. Some of Brunn's clan thought I would never become a woman. They thought I would never have children because my totem was too strong for a woman, Ayla said. But obviously you did. Ayla paused, thinking. Only women can give birth, but if women get pregnant by a mixing of spirits, why did Dani create men? Just for company? Just for pleasures? I think there has to be some other reason. Women can be company for each other. They can support each other, take care of each other. They can even give each other pleasures. Ataroa of the Sarmunai hated men. She kept them locked up. She would not allow them to share the gift of pleasure with women. The women shared their homes with other women. Ataroa thought if she did away with men, the spirits of women would be forced to blend, and they would have only girls. But it wasn't working. Some of the women shared pleasures, but they could not couple. They could not mix their essences. Very few children were born.
But some children were born? Zelandani asked.
Some, but they weren't all girls. Ataroa crippled two of the boys. Most of the women did not feel the way Ataroa did. Some of them sneaked in to visit their men. Some of the women Ataroa used to guard the men helped them. The women with children were the ones who had a man to share their fires the first night the men were free. They were the ones who were mated, or wanted to be. I think the only reason they had children was because they visited a man. It wasn't that they shared a hearth and were together long enough for a man to show he was worthy so his spirit would be chosen. They saw their men seldom, and only for a little while, barely long enough to couple. It was dangerous. Ataroa would have had them killed if she found out. I think it was the coupling that made the women pregnant.
Zelandani nodded.
Your reasoning is interesting, Ayla. We are taught that it is a mixing of spirits, and that seems to answer most questions about how life begins. But most people don't question it. They just accept it. Your childhood was different. You are more ready to question. But I would be careful about whom you discuss this idea with. There are some who would be quite upset. I have wondered sometimes why Dani made men. It is true that women could take care of themselves and each other if they had to. I have even wondered why she made male animals. Mother animals often take care of their young alone, and the males and females don't spend much time together, only at certain times of the year, when they share pleasures.
Ayla felt encouraged to press her point.
When I lived with the Mamutoi, there was a man of the lion camp. His name was Reinik, and he lived with Waimez, the flintknapper.
The one Jandalar talks about?
Yes. Waimez went on a very long journey when he was a young man. He could count 10 more years before he returned. Waimez traveled south of the Great Sea, around the eastern end of it, and then west again. He mated a woman he met there, and was trying to bring her and her son back to the Mamutoi, but she died on the way. He brought only the son of his mate with him when he returned. He told me his mate had skin almost as black as night. All of her people did. She had Reinik after they were mated, and Waimez said he looked different from all the other children because he was so light, but he looked very dark to me. His skin was brown. He was nearly as dark as Racer, and his hair was tight black curls, Ayla said.
You think that this man was brown because his mother was almost black and her mate was light?
That could be caused by a mixing of spirits, too, Zelandani said.
It could, Ayla admitted. It's what the Mamutoi believed. But if everyone else there was black except Waimez, wouldn't there be many more black spirits for his mother's spirit to mix with? They were mated. They must have shared pleasures.
She looked at her baby, then at Zelandani again.
It would have been interesting to see what our children would have looked like if I had joined with Reinik.
That's who you were going to mate?
Ayla smiled.
He had laughing eyes and smiling white teeth. He was clever and funny. He made me laugh, and he was the best carver I have ever seen. He made a special danyi for me and a carving of Winnie. He loved me. He said he wanted to join with me more than anything he ever wanted in his life. He looked like no one I have ever seen before or since. He was so different, even his features were different. I was fascinated by him. If I hadn't already loved Jandalar, I could have loved Renik.
If he was all that, I don't blame you, Zelandani said, smiling back. It's interesting. There are rumors about some dark-skinned people living with a cave to the south, beyond the mountains on the shore of the Great Sea. A young man and his mother, it was said. I never really believed it. You never know how much truth there is in such stories, and it seemed so incredible. Now I'm not so sure.
Renik did resemble Wymas, in spite of the difference in skin color and features. They were the same size, had the same shaped body, and they walked exactly alike, Ayla said.
You don't have to go that far afield to find resemblances, Zelandani said. Many children bear a similarity to the mate of the mother. But there are some who look like other men of the cave, some who hardly know the mother at all.
It could have happened during a festival or ceremony to honor the mother. Don't many women share pleasures with men who are not their mates, then?
Ayla asked.
Zelandani was quiet, thinking.
Ayla, this idea of yours will require deep thought and consideration. I don't know if you understand the implications. If it is true, it would cause changes that neither you nor I can even imagine. Such a revelation could only come from the Zelandanya, Ayla. No one would accept such an idea unless they believed it came from one who speaks for the Great Earth Mother herself. Who have you talked to about this?
Only Jandalar, and now you, Ayla said.
I suggest that you say nothing to anyone else just yet. I will talk to Jandalar and impress upon him the necessity of speaking to no one either. They both sat quietly, immersed in their own thoughts.
Zelandani, Ayla said, do you ever wonder what it would feel like to be a man?
That's a strange thing to wonder about.
I was thinking about something Jandalar said. It was when I wanted to go hunting, and he didn't want me to go. I know that part of the reason was that he was planning to come back here and build our home, but there was more to it than that. He said something about wanting a purpose. What's a man's purpose if women have children and provide for them, too? That's how he said it. I never thought about a purpose for living before. What would it feel like to think my life had no meaning?
You can carry that a step further, Ayla. You know part of your purpose is to bring forth the next generation. But what is the purpose of having another generation? What is the purpose of life?
I don't know. What is the purpose of life? Ayla asked.
Zelandani laughed. If I could answer that, I'd be equal to the Great Mother herself, Ayla. Only she can answer that question. There are many who claim our purpose is to honor her. Perhaps our purpose is just to live and to care for the next generation so that they may live. That may be the best way to honor her. The mother's song says she made us because she was lonely, that she wanted to be remembered and acknowledged. But there are those who say there is no purpose. I doubt if that question can be answered in this world, Ayla. I'm not sure if it can be answered in the next.
But at least women know they are necessary for there to be a next generation. How must it feel not to have even that much purpose? Ayla said. How would it feel to think life would go on just the same whether you were here or not, whether your kind, your gender, was here or not?
Ayla, I have never had any children. Should I feel my life has no purpose? Zelandani asked.
It's not the same. Perhaps you could have had children, and if you could not, you are still a woman. You still belong to the gender that brings forth life, Ayla said.
But we are all human, including men. We're all just people. Both men and women continue on to the next generation. Women have boys as often as they have girls, the Danyar said.
That's just it. Women have boys as often as girls. What do the men have to do with it? If you felt that you and all of your kind had no part in creating that next generation, would you feel as human, or would you feel less important? Something added on at the last moment, something unnecessary.
Ayla was leaning forward, strongly making her points, passionate in her feelings about them. Zelandani pondered the question, then looked at the serious face of the young woman with the sleeping baby in her arms.
You belong to the Zelandanya, Ayla. You argue as well as any of them, she said.
Ayla pulled back.
I don't want to be a Zelandani, she said.
The heavy woman eyed her with speculation.
Why not? I just want to be a mother and Jandalar's mate, Ayla said. Don't you want to be a healer anymore? You are as skilled as anyone, including me,
the Danya said. Ayla frowned.
Well, yes, I want to keep on being a healer, too.
You said you assisted your Mammut a few times in some of his other duties. Didn't you find it interesting? Said the one who was first.
It was interesting, Ayla conceded, especially learning things I didn't know. But it was frightening, too.
How much more frightening would it have been if you had been alone and unprepared?
Ayla, you are a daughter of the Mammoth Hearth. Mammut had a reason for adopting you. I can see it. I think you can, too. Look inside yourself. Have you ever been frightened by something strange and unfamiliar when you were alone?
Ayla refused to look at Zelandani, looking away and then down, but she nodded just slightly.
You know there is something different about you, something few people have, don't you? You try to ignore it, put it out of your mind, but it's difficult sometimes, isn't it?
Ayla glanced up. Zelandani was staring at her, forcing her to look back, holding her eyes the way she had done the first time they met. Ayla struggled to look away, but couldn't quite do it.
Yes, she said softly. It is difficult sometimes.
Zelandani released her hold, and Ayla looked down again.
No one becomes Zelandani unless they feel the call, Ayla,
the woman said gently.
But what if you should feel the call and not be prepared? Don't you think it would be better to have some training, just in case? The possibility is there, no matter how much you may want to deny it to yourself. But doesn't the preparation in itself make it more likely?
Ayla asked.
Yes, it does, but it can be interesting. I'll be honest with you. I want an acolyte. I don't have too many years left. I want the one who follows me to be trained by me. This is my cave. I want the best for it. I am first among those who serve the Great Earth Mother. I don't say this often, but I am not first without reason. If a person is gifted, no one could train her better than I can. You are gifted, Ayla. You are, perhaps, more gifted than I am. You could be first,
Zelandani said.
What about Jonakol?
Ayla asked. You should know the answer to that. Jonakol is an excellent artist. He was happy to remain an acolyte. He never wanted to become a Zelandani until you showed him that cave. You know he'll be gone by next summer. He will move to the 19th cave as soon as he can get the Zelandani of the 19th to accept him and find an excuse to leave me. He wants that cave, Ayla, and I think he should have it. He will not only make it beautiful. In that cave, he will bring to life the world of the spirits, Zelandani said.
Look at this, Ayla, Jandalar said,
holding a flint point. He was full of excitement.
I heated the flint the way Wymez does, very hot. I knew I had it right when it cooled because it felt shiny and slick, almost as if it had been oiled. Then I retouched it bifacially, using the pressure techniques he developed. It still isn't up to his quality, but I think with practice I may get close. I can see all kinds of possibilities. I can remove those long, thin flakes now. That means I can make points almost as thin as I want and get a long, straight edge for a knife or a spear without the curve that you always get when you start with a blade detached from a core. I can even straighten those blades more easily with careful retouching on the inner side of both ends of a curved blade. I can make any kind of notch I want. I can make shouldered points with a tang for hafting. You can't believe the control it gives me. I can do anything I want. It's almost like bending the stone to your will. That Wymez is a genius.
Ayla smiled at him going on and on. Wymez may be a genius, Jandalar, but you are just as good, she said.
I only wish I were. Remember, he developed the process. I'm only trying to copy it. It's too bad he lives so far away, but I am grateful for the time I had with him. I wish Dalinar were here. He said he was going to experiment this winter, too, and I'd really like to discuss it with him.
Jandalar examined the blade again, looking it over critically. Then he looked up and smiled at her.
I almost forgot to tell you. I am definitely going to be taking on Madigan as an apprentice for more than this winter. Since he came to visit, I've been able to judge, and I think he does have talent and ability with the stone. I've had a long talk with his mother and her mate, and Joharan is agreeable.
I like Madigan, Ayla said. I'm glad you will be teaching him your craft. You have so much patience, and you are the best flint napper of the Ninth Cave, probably of all the Zelandanyi.
Jandalar smiled at her words. One's mate always made favorable comparisons, he said to himself. But at a deeper level, he thought it might be true. Would it be all right if he stays with us all the time?
I think I would like that. We have so much room in the main room. We can take part of it to make him a sleeping room, she said. I hope the baby doesn't disturb him. Janela still wakes up at night.
Young men tend to be sound sleepers. I don't think he even hears her.
I have been meaning to talk to you about something Zelandani said, Ayla said. Jandalar thought she looked a bit troubled. It was probably his imagination. Zelandani asked me to be her acolyte. She wants to train me, Ayla blurted out.
Jandalar's head snapped up. I didn't know you were interested in becoming a Zelandani, Ayla.
I didn't think I was. I still don't know if I am. She has said before that she thought I belonged in the Zelandanya, but the first time she asked me to be her acolyte was right after Janela was born. She says she really needs someone, and I already know something about healing. Just because I'm an acolyte doesn't mean I will necessarily become a Zelandani. Janakal has been an acolyte for a long time, Ayla said, looking down at the vegetables she was cutting.
Jandalar walked over to her and lifted her chin to look directly at her. Her eyes did look troubled. Ayla, everyone knows the only reason Janakal is Zelandani's acolyte is because he's such a good artist. He captures the spirit of animals with great skill, and Zelandani needs him for the ceremonies. He will never be a Danya.
He might. Zelandani says he wants to move to the 19th cave, Ayla said.
It's that new cave you found, isn't it?
Jandalar said.
Well, he'd be the right person for it. But if you become an acolyte, you would become a Zelandani, wouldn't you?
Ayla still could not refuse to answer a direct question or to tell a lie. Yes, Jandalar, she said. I think some day I would be a Zelandani if I join the Zelandanya, but not right away.
Is it what you want to do? Or has Zelandani talked you into it because you're a healer?
Jandalar wanted to know. She says I already am Zelandani in a way. Maybe she's right. I don't know. She says I should be trained for my own protection. It could be very dangerous for me if I feel a call and I'm not prepared for it, Ayla said.
She had never told him about the strange things that happened to her, and it felt like a lie not telling him. Even in the clan, one could refrain from mentioning. It bothered her, but she still didn't tell him. It was Jandalar's turn to look troubled. There isn't much I can say about it one way or another. It's your choice. It probably is best to be prepared. You don't know how you scared me when you and Mahmut made that strange journey. I thought you were dead, and I begged the Great Mother to bring you back. I don't think I ever begged for anything so hard in my life, Ayla. I hope you never do anything like that again.
I thought it was you, not at first, but later. Mahmut said, someone called us back. called with such force it could not be denied. I thought I saw you there when I came back to myself, but then I didn't see you, Ayla said.
You were promised to Rainik. I didn't want to be in the way,
Jandalar said, vividly recalling that terrible night. But you loved me. If you hadn't loved me so much, my spirit might still be lost in that empty void. Mammut said he would never go there again like that, and he told me that if I ever take that journey again, I should make sure I have strong protection, or I might not return.
Suddenly she reached for him.
Why me, Jandalar? She cried. Why do I have to be a Zelindani?
Jandalar held her.
Yes, he thought, why her? He recalled the Danyar talking about the responsibilities and the dangers.
Now he understood why she had been so open. She had been trying to prepare them. She must have known all along, from the first day they arrived, just like Mammut seemed to know. That's why he adopted her to his hearth.
Can I be the mate of a Zelindani?
He thought about his mother and Dalinar. She said he had not been able to stay with her because she was the leader. The demands on a Zelindani are even greater.
Everyone said he was just like Dalinar. There was no doubt he was the son of Dalinar's spirit. But Ayla says it was not just spirits. She says Janela is my daughter. If she's right, then I must be Dalinar's son. The thought stunned him. Could he be as much Dalinar's son as he was Marthonas? If he was, would he be so much like him that he would not be able to live with a woman whose duties were so important? It was a very disturbing idea. He felt Ayla shaking in his arms, and he looked at her.
What's wrong, Ayla?
I'm afraid, Jandalar. That's why I don't want to do it. I'm afraid to be Zelindani, she sobbed.
She quieted down and pulled away.
The reason I'm so afraid, Jandalar, is that things have happened to me that I never told you.
What kind of things? He asked, his forehead wrinkled in a frown.
I never told you because I didn't know how to explain. I'm still not sure I can, but I'll try. When I lived with Brun's clan, you know I went with them to a clan gathering. Issa was too sick to go. She died soon after we returned.
Ayla's eyes started to fill at the memory.
Issa was the medicine woman. It was she that was supposed to prepare the special drink for the Mogurs. No one else knew how. Uba was too young, not a woman yet, and it had to be prepared by a woman. Issa explained it to me before we left. I didn't think the Mogurs would allow me to make it. They said I wasn't clan. But then Kreb came and told me to prepare myself. It was the same drink I made for Mammut and me when we took our strange journey. But I didn't know how to do it right, and I ended up drinking some of it, too. I didn't even know where I was going when I followed the Mogurs back into the cave. The drink was so powerful, I may have already been in the spirit world. When I saw the Mogurs, I hid and watched. But Kreb knew I was there. I told you Kreb was a powerful magician. He was like Zelindani, first, the Mogur. He was directing everything, and somehow my mind joined with theirs. I went back with them, back to the beginnings. I can't explain it, but I was there. As we came back to the present, we came to this place. Kreb blocked out the others. They didn't know I was with them. But then he left them and followed me. I know it was this place. I recognize the Falling Stone. The clan lived here for generations. I can't tell you how long.
In spite of himself, Jandalar was fascinated.
Long ago, we started from the same people, Ayla continued. But then we changed. The clan was left behind when we went ahead. As powerful as he was, Kreb couldn't follow me, but he saw something or felt something. Then he told me to leave, get out of the cave. It was like I heard him inside me, inside my head, as though he were talking to me. The other Mogurs never knew I was there, and he never told them. They would have killed me.
Women were not allowed to participate in those ceremonies. Craig changed after that. He was never the same again. He began to lose his power. I think he didn't like directing the mines anymore. I don't know how, but somehow I hurt him. I wish I had never done it. But he did something to me, too. I've been different since then. My dreams feel different, and sometimes I feel strange, as though I go away someplace else, and I don't know how to say it, but it's like I know what people are thinking sometimes. No, that's not quite right either. It's more like I know what they are feeling, but that's not exactly right either. What they are... I don't know the right words, Jandalar. I block it out most of the time anyway, but sometimes things get through, especially when there are very strong emotions, like Brookavall's.
Jandalar was looking at her strangely. Do you know what I am thinking? What thoughts are in my head?
No, I never know thoughts exactly, but I know that you love me.
She watched his expression change.
It bothers you, doesn't it? Maybe I shouldn't have said anything, she mumbled,
feeling Jandalar's emotions like a weight. She was always particularly perceptive to Jandalar. She put her head down, her shoulders slumped. He could see her dejection, and suddenly his uneasy feeling evaporated. He took both her shoulders and made her look up, then looked into her eyes. They had that incredibly ancient look he had seen occasionally before, and a sadness, a deep, ineffable melancholy.
I have nothing to hide from you, Ayla. I don't care if you know what I'm thinking or feeling. I love you. I'll never stop loving you.
Tears spilled out of her eyes, as much from relief as from love. She reached up to kiss him as he bent his head toward her. He held her tightly, wanting to protect her from anything that might cause her pain, and she held him. As long as she had Jandalar, nothing else really mattered, did it? Just then, Janela started to cry.
I just want to be a mother and be mated to you, Jandalar. I don't really want to be a Zelandani,
Ayla said as she went to pick her up. She is really scared, he thought, but who wouldn't be? I don't even like getting near a burial ground, much less think about visiting the world of the spirits. He watched her come back to him with the baby in her arms, tears still in her eyes, and felt a sudden surge of love and protectiveness for the woman and the baby. So what if she became Zelandani? She would still be Ayla to him, and she would still need him.
It will be all right, Ayla, he said,
taking the baby from her and cradling her in his arms. He had never been happier than he had been since they were mated, and especially since Janela was born. He looked down at the infant and smiled. I believe she is my daughter, too, he thought.
It's up to you, Ayla, he said. You're right. Even if you join the Zelandania, it doesn't mean you will have to be a Zelandani. But if you do, that will be all right, too. I always knew I was mating someone special. Not only a beautiful woman, but one with a rare gift. You were chosen by the mother. That's an honor, and she showed it by honoring you at our mating. And now you have a beautiful daughter. No, we have a beautiful daughter. You said she's my daughter too, right?
He said, trying to calm her fears. Her tears spilled again, but she smiled through them.
Yes, Janela is your daughter and my daughter, she said,
then broke out in new sobs. He reached out for her with his other arm and held them both.
If you ever stopped loving me, Jandalar, I don't know what I would do. Please never stop loving me.
Of course I'll never stop loving you. I'll always love you. Nothing can ever make me stop,
Jandalar said, feeling it deep in his heart and hoping that it would always be true. Winter finally came to an end. The drifts of snow, dirty from dust blowing on the wind, melted, and the first crocuses poked their purple and white flowers through the last vestiges of it. The icicles dripped until they disappeared, and the first green buds appeared. Ayla was spending a great deal of time with Winnie.
With her baby held close to her in a carrying cloak, she walked with the mare or rode her slowly. Racer was feeling more frisky, and even Jandalar had some trouble controlling him, but he rather enjoyed the challenge. Winnie wickered at the sight of her, and she patted and hugged her affectionately. She planned to meet Jandalar and several people at a small abri downstream. They wanted to tap a few birch trees, part of which would be boiled down into a rich syrup. Another part would be allowed to ferment to make a light alcoholic beverage. It wasn't far, but she had decided to take Winnie for a ride, mostly because she wanted to stay close to her. She was almost there when it started to rain. She urged Winnie faster and noticed that the mare seemed to be breathing hard. Ayla felt her rounded sides just as the mare had another contraction.
"Winnie," she said aloud, "your time has come, hasn't it? I wonder how close you are to giving birth. We are not far from the abri where I'm supposed to meet everyone. I hope you won't be too bothered by having other people around you."
When she reached the camp, she asked Joharan if she could bring Winnie under the abri. The mare was about to give birth. He was quick to agree, and a wave of excitement spread among the group. This would be an experience. None of them had ever been close to a horse giving birth. She led Winnie under the overhanging upper ledge. Jandalar rushed over and asked if she needed any help.
"I don't think Winnie needs my help, but I want to be close to her," Ayla said. "If you would watch Janela, it would help me. I just nursed her. She should be all right for a while."
He reached for Janela. She saw his face and gave him a big, delighted smile. She had only recently started smiling and had begun to greet the man of her hearth with that sign of recognition.
"You have your mother's smile, Janela," he said as he picked her up, looking directly at her and smiling back.
The baby focused on his face, made a soft cooing sound, and smiled again. It melted his heart. He tucked Janela into the crook of his arm and walked back toward the people at the other end of the small shelter. Winnie seemed to be happy to be out of the wet weather. Ayla rubbed the mare down and led her to an area of dry soil as far away from the people as she could. They seemed to sense that Ayla wanted them to keep some distance away, but the space was small, and they had no trouble seeing. Jandalar turned around to watch with them. It was not the first time he had seen Winnie give birth, but the idea was no less exciting. Familiarity with the process of birth did not diminish the sense of awe at the new life about to make an appearance. Human or animal, it was still Donnie's greatest gift. They all waited quietly. After a while, when it seemed that Winnie was not quite ready but as comfortable as she could be, Ayla walked to the fire where the people were waiting to get a drink of water. She was offered hot tea, and she returned for it after bringing some water to the horse.
"Ayla, I don't think I've ever heard you tell how you found your horses," Dinota said. "What makes them unafraid of people?"
Ayla smiled. She was getting used to telling stories, and she didn't mind talking about her horses. She quickly told how she had trapped and killed the horse that had been Winnie's dam, then noticed the young foal and the hyenas. She explained that she brought the baby horse to her cave, fed her, and raised her. She warmed to the tale, and without realizing it, the skill she had developed in the course of living with the people of the clan, of showing meaning by expression and gesture, crept into her narration. With half her mind on the mare, she unconsciously dramatized the events, and the people, several from other nearby caves, were captivated. Her exotic accent and her uncanny ability to mimic the sounds of animals added an interesting element to her unusual story. Even Jandalar was entranced, although he knew the circumstances. He had not heard her tell the whole story quite like that. More questions were asked, and she began to describe her life in the valley. But when she told about finding and raising a cave lion, there were expressions of disbelief. Jandalar was quick to back her up. Whether they entirely believed her or not, the story of a lion, a horse, and a woman all living together in a cave in a secluded valley was an enjoyable one. A sound from the mare stopped her from continuing. Ayla jumped up and went to Winnie, who was by then lying on her side. A membrane-encased head of a foal began to emerge. For the second time, she played midwife to the mare. Before the hindquarters were fully out, the wet, newborn foal was trying to stand. Winnie looked back to see what she had done and nickered softly at her new baby. Still on the ground, the baby started squirming toward Winnie's head, stopping for a moment to try to nurse before either was standing. When she reached her dam, the mare immediately started washing her with her tongue. Within moments, the tiny horse was trying to stand. She fell over on her nose, but by the second try she was on her feet, only several moments after foaling. A very strong little horse, Ayla thought. As soon as the baby was standing, Winnie got up, and the moment she was on her feet, the foal was nuzzling her, again trying to nurse, ducking under at first, not quite able to find the right place. After a second pass under her hind legs, Winnie gave the baby a little nip to point the foal in the right direction. That was all it took. Winnie had been perfectly capable, without any assistance, to give birth to her spindly-legged foal. The people had watched silently, seeing for the first time the knowledge that the great Earth Mother had given to her wild creatures about how to take care of their newborn. The only way the young of Winnie's species could survive, and most of the other animals that grazed the vast steppes in great numbers, was for the young to be able to stand on their own legs and to run nearly as fast as an adult shortly after birth. Without that, they would have been such easy prey to predators they could not have lived. With her baby nursing, Winnie seemed content. The birth of the horse was rare entertainment for the people who were watching, and a story that would be told and retold in the future by everyone who had witnessed it. Several people had questions and comments for Ayla once both horses were comfortable and Ayla returned. "I didn't realize that babies of horses can walk almost from the time they're born. It takes at least a year for a human baby to walk. Do they grow faster, too?" "Yes," Ayla replied. "Racer was born the day after I found Jandalar. He's a full-grown stallion now, and he only counts 3 years of life."
"You're going to have to think of a name for the young one, Ayla," Jandalar said.
"Yes, but I will have to think about it," Ayla said.
Jandalar was quick to catch her implication. It was true that the hay-colored mare had given birth to a horse of a different color. It was also true that among the horses on the eastern steppes, near the region of the Mamutoi, there were some that were shades of dark brown, like Racer. He wasn't sure what color the little filly would be, but it didn't seem that she would have her mother's coloring. Wolf found them shortly after. As though he instinctively knew to approach the new family carefully, he first went to Winnie. Despite her instincts, she had learned that this was not a carnivore to be feared. Ayla joined them, and after Winnie satisfied herself that this wolf was the exception, especially since the woman was around, she allowed him to sniff her new baby and let the baby learn his smell. The young horse was a gray filly.
"I think I'm going to call her Gray," she said to Jandalar. "And she should be Janela's horse, but we'll have to teach them both."
He grinned with delight at the prospect. The next day, when they were back at the horse area on the ledge, Racer welcomed his new little sister with avid curiosity, but under the strict supervision of Winnie. Ayla happened to be looking toward the dwelling area when she saw Zelandani coming. She was surprised to see the Danyer coming to see the new foal. She seldom made any special effort to see the animals. Other people had found occasions to take peeks, and Ayla asked that they not go too close at first. But the Danyer got a personal introduction to Gray.
"Jonakal has told me he will be leaving the Ninth Cave when we go to the summer meeting," the Danyer announced, after she had examined the foal.
"Well, you expected it," Ayla said, feeling edgy.
"Have you decided yet if you're going to be my new acolyte?"
she asked, directly, not hesitating. Ayla looked down, then back at the woman. Zelandani waited, then looked into Ayla's eyes.
"I think you have no choice. You know you will feel the call one day, perhaps sooner than you think. I would hate to see your potential destroyed,
even if you were able to survive it without support and training.
Ayla struggled to break away from the commanding stare. Then, from the depths of her being, or the pathways in her brain, she found a resource. She felt a power rising within her, and knew that she was no longer constrained by the Danyer, but instead felt that she had dominion over the one who was first, and held her gaze. It gave her a sense of something indescribable, a feeling of strength, of mastery, of authority that she had never consciously felt before. When she released the woman, Zelandani glanced away for an instant. When she looked back, the feeling of tremendous power that had held her was gone, but Ayla was looking at her with a knowing smile. The infant in her arms began to move as though something was bothering her, and Ayla's attention went back to her child. Zelandani was shaken, but she controlled it quickly. She turned to leave, but turned back and studied Ayla again, not with the gaze that engendered the contest of wills, but with a straightforward, piercing look.
"Tell me now you are not Zelandani, Ayla," she said quietly.
Ayla flushed and glanced around with uncertainty, as though trying to find some escape. When she looked back at the large woman, Zelandani was the commanding presence she had always known.
"I will tell Jandalar," she said, then quickly looked down at the baby.
Acknowledgements. I am more grateful than I can say for the assistance of many people who have helped me to learn about the ancient world of the people who lived when glaciers advanced far south of today's margins and covered a quarter of the Earth's surface. However, there are some details which I have chosen to use, particularly with regard to certain theories and the timing of certain sites and events, which may not be accepted by the majority of the professional community at this time. Some may be oversights, but others were chosen deliberately, usually because it felt more accurate to this subjective novelist who must write about people with an understanding of human nature and logical motivation for their actions. Most especially, I want to thank Dr. Jean-Philippe Rigaud, whom I met on my first research trip to Europe at his archaeological excavation named Flageolet in southwest France, once a hunting camp on a hillside that overlooked a broad grassy plain and the migrating Ice Age animals it supported. Though I was just an unknown American novelist, he took the time to explain some of the discoveries of that site, and he helped to arrange a visit to Lascaux Cave. I was brought to tears when I saw that sanctuary of prehistoric splendor painted by those early modern humans of Upper Paleolithic Europe, the Cro-Magnons, work that can still stand against the finest of today. Later, when we met again at La Micoque, a very early Neanderthal site, I began to get more of a sense of the unique time at the beginning of our prehistory when the first anatomically modern humans arrived in Europe and encountered the Neanderthals who had been living there since long before the last Ice Age. Because I wanted to understand the process that is used to learn about our ancient ancestors, my husband and I worked for a short time at Dr. Rigaud's more recent excavation, Gratte 16. He also gave me many insights into the rich and expansive living site, which today is named Le Jury Haute, but that I have called the Ninth Cave of the Zelandani. Dr. Rigaud has been of help throughout the series, but I appreciate his assistance with this book in particular. Before I started writing The Shelters of Stone, I took all the information I had gathered about the region and the way it was then and wrote the entire background setting in terms of the story, giving the sites my own names and describing the landscape so that when I needed the information, it was easily available in my own words. I have asked many scientists and other specialists uncountable questions, but I never asked anyone to check my work before it was published. I have always taken full responsibility for the choices I made in selecting the details that were used in my books, for the way I decided to use them and the imagination I added to them, and I still do. But because the setting for this novel is so well known,
not only to archaeologists and other professionals, but to the many people who have visited the region, I needed to be sure that my background details were as accurate as I could make them. So I did something I had never done before. I asked Dr. Rigaud, who knows the region and understands the archaeology, to check over those many, many pages of background material for obvious errors. I didn't fully realize what a huge job I had asked of him, and I thank him profoundly for his time and efforts. He paid me the compliment of saying that the information was reasonably accurate, but he also told me some things I didn't know or hadn't understood, which I was able to correct and incorporate. Any mistakes remaining are entirely mine. I am deeply grateful to another French archaeologist, Dr. Jean Clot, whom I met through his colleague, Dr. Rigaud. In Montignac, at the celebration for the 50th anniversary of the discovery of Lascaux Cave, he was kind enough to translate for me in quiet tones the gist of some of the presentations given in French at the conference that was held in conjunction with the Lascaux event. Over the years since then, we have met on both sides of the Atlantic, and I cannot thank him enough for his kindness and exceptional generosity with his time and assistance. He has guided me through many painted and engraved caves, especially in the region near the Pyrenees Mountains. Besides the fabulous caves on Count Beguin's property, I was particularly impressed with Garga, which has so much more than the handprints for which it is so well known. I also appreciated more than I can say my second visit deep into Neo Cave with him, which lasted about 6 hours and was a wonderful revelation, partly because by then I had learned much more about the painted caves than I knew the first time. Though these places are not yet included in the story, the many discussions with him about concepts and ideas, especially regarding the reasons that the Cro-Magnons may have had for decorating their caves and living sites, have been enlightening. I made my first visit to the Cave of Neo in the foothills of the Pyrenees in 1982, for which I must thank Dr. Jean-Michel Bellamy. I was indelibly impressed with Neo. The animals painted on the walls of the black salon, the children's footprints, the beautifully painted horses deep inside the extensive cavern beyond the small lake, and much more. I was moved beyond words for Dr. Bellamy's more recent gift of the exceptional first edition of the first book about the Cave of Neo. I feel gratitude beyond measure to Count Robert Beguin, who has protected and preserved the remarkable caves on his land, Len Tuk Tadoubert and Trois Frères, and established a unique museum for the artifacts that have been so carefully excavated from them. I was overwhelmed with the two caves I saw, and am deeply grateful to him and Dr. Clot for guiding my visits. I also want to thank Dr. David Lewis Williams, a gentleman with strong convictions, whose work with the Bushmen in Africa and the remarkable rock paintings of their ancestors has engendered profound and fascinating ideas and several books, one co-written with Dr. Clot, The Shamans of Prehistory, which suggests that the ancient French cave painters may have had similar reasons for decorating the rock walls of their caves. Thanks are also owed to Dr. Roy Larrick for his helpfulness and especially for unlocking the protective metal door and showing me the beautiful horse head carved in deep relief on the wall in the lower cave at Comarc. I am also grateful to Dr. Paul Bonn for helping me to understand some of the conference presentations at the Lascaux anniversary meeting by translating them for me. Through his efforts, I had the honor of meeting three of the men who, as boys, discovered the beautiful cave of Lascaux in the 1940s. The sight brought me to tears when I saw its white walls filled with such remarkable polychrome paintings. I can only imagine the impression it must have made on the four boys who followed a dog into a hole and saw the cave for the first time since its entrance collapsed 15,000 years ago. Dr. Bonn has been of great assistance to me, both through discussions and his books about the intriguing prehistoric era that are the subject of this series of novels. I feel great warmth and gratitude to Dr. Jan Jelinek for continued discussions about the Upper Paleolithic era. His insights about the people who lived during the time when anatomically modern humans arrived and settled in Europe and met the Neanderthals who were living there are always valuable. I also want to thank him for his assistance to the Czech publishers in their translations of the previous books in this series. I read the books of Dr. Alexander Marshak, who pioneered the technique of examining carved artifacts under a microscope, long before I met him, and I appreciate the efforts he has made into the understanding of Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals and the papers he sends me. I have been impressed with his cogent and thoughtful theories based on his careful studies, and continue to read his work for his penetrating and intelligent perceptions about the people who lived during the last ice age. During the 3 months I lived near Les Isies de Taillac in southwest France doing research for this book, I visited Fond de Combe Cave many times. I owe special thanks to Paulette Daubis, who was the director and in charge of the people who guided the visitors to that beautifully painted ancient cave, for her kindness, and particularly for giving me a special private tour. She lived with that very singular site for many years and knew it as though it were her own home. She showed me many formations and paintings that are not usually presented to the casual visitor. It would make the tours far too long, and I am more grateful than she can know for the unique insights that were revealed. I also want to thank Monsieur Renaud Bombard of Presse de la Cité, my French publisher, for his willingness to help me find whatever I needed whenever I was in France doing research. Whether it was a place to make copies of a large manuscript not too far from where I was staying, with someone there who could speak English so I could explain what I needed, or a good hotel in the region during the off-season when most hotels were closed, or a fabulous restaurant in the Loire Valley where we could celebrate the anniversary of dear friends, or late reservations in a popular resort area on the Mediterranean, which happened to be on the way to a site I wanted to see. Whatever it was, Monsieur Bombard always managed to make it happen, and I am truly grateful. In order to write this book, I had to learn about more than archaeology and paleoanthropology, and there are several other people who were of great assistance. A sincere thank you to Dr. Ronald Nato, Doctor of Internal Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and my personal physician for many years, who was willing to call me after his office hours and answer my questions about the symptoms and progression of certain illnesses and injuries. I also want to thank Dr. Brett Ballhoffner, Doctor of Orthopedic Medicine in St. Petersburg, Florida, for his information about bone trauma and injuries, but even more, for putting my son's shattered hip and pelvis back together after his automobile accident. Thanks also to Joseph J. Pica, orthopedic surgery and trauma and physician assistant to Dr. Ballhoffner, for his cogent explanation of internal injuries and his excellent care of my son. I also appreciated the discussion with Rick Fry, volunteer emergency paramedic in Washington State, about what to do first in medical emergencies. Thanks also to Dr. John Kalis, Portland, Oregon, expert in the collection of wild foods, who continually experiments with processing and cooking them, for sharing his extensive knowledge not only of wild plant foods, but also of clams, mussels, and vegetables from the sea. I had no idea there were so many different kinds of edible seaweed. And special thanks to Lynette Strobel of Prineville, Oregon, who has been breeding back from wild horses to the original tarpon and turning up some interesting characteristics. For example, they have hooves so hard they don't need horseshoes even on rocky ground. They have a stand-up mane, and they have markings similar to the horses painted on some cave walls, such as the dark legs and tail, and sometimes stripes on the flanks. And they have a beautiful gray color called gruya. She not only allowed me to see the horses, but she told me a great deal about them, and then sent a wonderful series of photographs of one of her mares giving birth, which gave me the basis for the birth of Winnie's foal. I am grateful to Claudine Fisher, professor of French at Portland State University and honorary French counsel for Oregon, for French translations of research material and correspondence, and for advice and insights about this and other manuscripts and additional things French. To early readers, Karen Owl Foyer, Kendall Owl, Kathy Humble, Deanna Sterrett, Claudine Fisher, and Ray Owl, who hurriedly read a first finished draft and offered some good constructive suggestions. Thank you. I am deeply indebted to Betty Prashker, my sharp, smart, and savvy editor. Her suggestions are always helpful, and her insights invaluable. Thanks beyond measure to my literary agent, Jean Nagar, who flew here to read the first finished draft, and along with her husband, Serge Nagar, made some suggestions, but told me it worked. She has been there from the beginning, performing miracles with this series. Thanks also to Jennifer Welts of the Jean V. Nagar Literary Agency, who is working with Jean to perform further miracles, especially with foreign rights. With great regret, I offer gratitude in memoriam to David Abrams, professor of anthropology and archaeology in Sacramento, California. In 1982, David and his research assistant and future wife, Diane Kelly, took Ray and me on my first research trip to Europe, France, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Ukraine, then Russia, to visit for the first time some of the sites where the books in the Earth's Children series took place some 30,000 years ago. I was able to get a sense of the localities, which helped me tremendously. We became friends with David and Diane and saw each other several times over the years, both here and in Europe. It was a shock to learn he was so ill. He was too young to go. But he held on with perseverance for much longer than anyone predicted, always keeping a wonderfully positive attitude. I miss him. I must thank another dear friend in memoriam, Richard Osman, who helped me to write these books by designing comfortable places where I could live and work. Oz had a special genius for creating beautiful and efficient homes, but more than that, he had been a good friend to both Ray and me for years. He thought they had caught the cancer in time and married Paula, hoping for many more years with her and her children, but it was not to be. I feel great sadness that he is no longer with us. There are many others I probably should thank for insights and assistance, but this is too long already, so I will end with the one who counts the most. I am grateful to Ray for his love, support, and encouragement, for helping to provide the time and space for me to work, in spite of my strange hours, and for being there.
This is Laura Grafton of Brilliance Audio, and I'm here today to talk to the internationally best-selling author of the Earth's Children series, Jean M. Owl. Hello, Jean.
Hi, Laura.
Jean, the last book in this series, The Plains of Passage, was published in 1990. That's 11 years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing since then?
It's very difficult, actually, to try, and I know what the question really is. It's why did it take so long to write this book? Because that's the question that I get. Basically, I don't have a good answer for that. Nothing serious has happened. I mean, I haven't died. I haven't had a stroke or a heart attack or cancer or any of the other grave illnesses that have been reported on the internet in various other ways. I have not had serious fights with husband, publisher, or any other one member of my family. Part of the reason is that these books take a while because they do take a certain amount of research, and it's not so much the research that's hard because that's fun. I get to go places and do things that I never dreamed I would be able to do. And that's kind of like eating the ice cream before the main course. Putting it then all together into a story takes a little more effort, but the hard work to me is writing. I don't ever want to do anything else, but it's the hardest work I've ever done. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, when I started writing, I had children in high school and college, and now I'm a grandmother. And sometimes life interferes with writing.
Where do you do your research?
First of all, I have direct contact with many of the professionals in the field now. I often get papers and materials directly from some of the specialists. I tend to find out what's going on. I mean, I sort of keep my ear to the ground. I subscribe to every, practically every journal, every archaeological and anthropological journal, you know, current anthropology and Arctic anthropology, Arctic this world prehistory, you know, most of the major legitimate journals, because I know that the material that's in those has been examined by people who are in the field and understand the field. I also subscribe to both Nature and Science, which are the A-list of magazines when it comes to science. And I go through them fairly carefully for what I want. That's where I get my material. And just talking, being in touch with the professionals in the field. I'd find out there's a new cave that was discovered south of the Lazy Z around Lemieux, which is very near where the Vézère River goes into the Dordogne. And it's engraved, and they have found some burials inside of it. And at first they thought the burials were more contemporary, because it's not customary for the Cro-Magnons to bury their dead in caves. These are dating about 25,000 years ago, I just found out. So that's going to add a whole other picture to this.
So it's forming as we speak,
yes.
The plot. But you know how it will end.
I thought I did. When I did this sort of rewriting, finishing, you know, in a draft, rough form to the end of the series, I'm now reconsidering where I thought the ending was going to be. So I have to think about that. So I'm not as sure as I was 5 years ago.
Well, from the ending, let's go back to the beginning, the Clan of the Cave Bear. What inspired Ayla's adventures?
It's another one of those nice questions that I could never answer. All I can really do is tell you where I was at the time in my life. Let's say I got married when I was 18. I had 5 children before I was 25 years old. I had my fourth one 4 days before I was 20, my fifth one 4 days before I was 25. I worked most of my life. I think I took off for 1 or 2 years when my last one was born, but most of the time I've worked at least part-time while I was raising children. And then it got to the place where when you have 5 children, one income just doesn't stretch. So I did go back to work. And then for a long time, my husband was going to school. He was in the Air Force, and he was going to school on the GI Bill. And then I got to be about 28, and I said, it's my turn to go to college. So from then on, I worked going to night school most of the time, and worked full-time and raised 5 kids and went to school. And by the time I was 40, I had just gotten my MBA. Now, I started out first taking math and physics classes because I thought I wanted to get into electronics. I was working for an electronics firm, and they were very good, very generous about covering the cost of education. Then I got into a management training program, and I bounced around the company. I started out in billing, and I got into circuit board design, and I got into technical writing, and I got into management, credit management. So all of a sudden, here at the age of 40, I now have 3 daughters in college and 2 sons in high school. I've graduated. I've gotten my MBA, so I'm not going to school anymore. And I had a little misunderstanding with my boss, and I quit. I felt that he didn't quite support me. And I think, if I'm honest with myself, that maybe part of it was I was glad, because I think I was ready to leave. But I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I thought I was going to do something great in business. And I was home, and I quit about Thanksgiving of 1976 and got through the holiday season, and it was about January or February. And I was spinning wheels, figuring out what I wanted to do, what kind of business I wanted to be in. And I got a funny idea for a story. And it was one of those, like a song that gets in your brain, you know, and you can't kind of get rid of it. It's thinking about it all day. This young woman who was living with people who were different, but they thought she was different. And so they were looking at her with some suspicion. that she was taking care of this old man with a crippled arm. And it got to be about 11 o'clock at night, and my husband was saying, come to bed. And I said, no, I want to see if I can write a short story. I'm still writing it.
Are there any plans to make any more of the books into film?
We get offers. And I've so far up to this stage, I have told my agent, I don't want to hear him for a while. I don't know. I mean, the time is coming when I'm getting closer. I didn't want to do anything until I finished the series, but it's taken so long to do this last book, and I don't think the next one will take as long, but I don't know. I'm a little more unsure in terms of where the series is going. So I don't know. I may get to a stage where I'm considering it. If I don't, I'll wait till I die and my kids can do it.
Finally, what do you hope people will take from your books when they read them? What do you want them to get out of them?
I want them to enjoy a good story. First and foremost, this has always, from the beginning, been story-driven, and it still is. But I wouldn't mind if they also took away that concept that I learned in the course of doing research, that those early human ancestors of ours were much, much more advanced than we tend to think of them. They earned their living in a different way, but the intelligence level's not different. They had the same range of intelligence. They had the same psychological reactions and emotional responses. That's the point that I really wanted to say is, because when I got into the research and I discovered this, I thought, how come I don't know this? Why do I have this Hollywood version that says that they were these cavemen that always walk around with a leopard skin over one shoulder because the other one never gets cold, of course. I mean, you see any cartoon, what's the vision? They've got a leopard skin over one shoulder, no matter what they're doing, even if they're painting pictures on walls or something. That's always the way they depict them.
Not to nag you, but the sixth book,
uh-huh.
Do you have a title for it?
No.
And do you have a projected publication date, or you not want to talk about it?
I don't have a projected date. I do think it'll take much less time. Part of what took time this time was that I did write a rough draft to the end of the series because I needed to know where I was going for sure. I mean, I did a rough draft. When I first did it, I did a rough draft that I thought was going to be one novel called Earth's Children, and I thought it was going to be one big saga in six parts. And when I went back and started rewriting, I realized I didn't have one novel. I had a series of six books. So I knew from the beginning that this was going to be a series before I ever finished the first one. Now, as I say, I have sort of, you know, written, the ending wasn't quite together in that first thing. I kind of had an idea where I was going, and I thought I knew. But now, since I've written to the end of the series, I'm thinking. I'm just rethinking. I don't know where I'm going yet. I'm thinking one more volume at this stage in the game.
Well, Jean, thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and we're looking forward to the publication of The Shelters of Stone.
Thank you very much.
Brilliance Audio would like to thank Jean M. Owl for her assistance with pronunciation and characterizations in this audiobook. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Shelters of Stone by Jean M. Owl. Copyright 2002 by Jean M. Owl. Read by Sandra Burr. Performance copyright 2002 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.